This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Good morning everybody, my name's John Williams, I'm the Dean of the Adelaide Law School but I'm also on the Advisory Committee for the Festival of Ideas, and should I say welcome to the, you know, the very hard core of the New Democracy people here on a Sunday morning, so congratulations on making it on what is a beautiful day out there. In 1999, I had the experience of being asked to join during the Republican referendum a version of a citizen's jury, though I was one of the people being interrogated, giving information. And I found it a very interesting experience, but I went into it, I should say, with some concern because of the very nature of these processes, you can't control them, and that itself can be a problematic, especially if you're a proponent of a change. What I was taken by was the quality of the questions, that once people decided that they would move out of their entrenched positions, and with people with an inquiring mind, people changed attitude from one side to the other and back. So I was always very excited about being asked to chair this session because it's an area that I've been watching for a while. My colleague here, Ian Walker, needs really no introduction here to South Australia. He's the Executive Director of the New Democracy Foundation, but has been intimately involved with those who have been following this South Australia and our jury system. So today we're going to have a fairly, I think, informal approach. We'll have an introduction and discussion from Ian, and then we'll open it up to the jury. So thank you very much. Without further ado, please welcome me.
Good morning. Thanks for braving a beautiful Sunday morning. I'd actually contest, I think I do need a little introduction because most people have no idea what we do or why we do it. So before we get to what we've done in South Australia, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we've got here. I'm really hoping you leave with one big idea, which is, what is democracy? That may seem like a stupidly easy question to answer. Let's see if your view changes over the next half hour or so. I just want to challenge what that definition is. As we start, and before I get to who we are and what we do, just want to start with that idea of democracy. Those of you, when you speak in the modern era, even though you've just been asked to turn phones off, invariably they'll be there. If you just Google the words natural aristocracy, it's interesting what you dig up. That's actually the phrase that's used in the Federalist Papers. When it comes to the founding of the US Constitution, why do we have the vote for the representative system? Because it's a neat way to preserve the natural aristocracy. That wasn't written by the opponents. That was written by those putting forward the model of the US Constitution. That is why we have voting, because those who will actually have the resources and power to contest office is a very small tier. So John Adams wrote about the fact that there are 5,000 people who form the cream of our society, and these will be the choice that you are given by the vote. And the anti-federalists wrote, you're going to get an aristocracy, you need to restrain it. That's actually one of the foundations of where we are today. Now, who we are as New Democracy, those of you who like to take a look and say, geez, you know, there's a few conspiracies around town, we are a private research foundation. We are funded by a high net worth, wealthy individual. It's worth bearing in mind how we ended up there. Luca Belgiorno-Nettis, his father started Transfield. Some of you may know it's been a significant construction and investment business. They own things like the Harbour Tunnel. As you can imagine, since he was about this high, he's been hit up for political donations. And in 2005, he basically cracked it. Now, you're at a fundraising dinner, you're at the good table, because they're expecting the big check. And he said, gee, this is ridiculous, isn't it? We all like to say we do this out of civic contribution, and we don't. You know why we do it? We want to know just, do we have a little access? Can we pick up the phone? Will we have the information? And he turned to the MP concerned, who's still around so we don't name them, and said, I tell you what, I'll write you one more check, and you put a change to how we do democracy on the agenda. That's the little bit of power I'd like to wield. And the MP amazingly said, I think you'll write your cheque anyway, and you can't change anything. Now, that is That is a courageous thing to say to someone who, look, owns tunnels. It's not would have been my starting point. Luca's next step is he contacted the University of Sydney. Just rang up, School of Government, and said, I want to find out who works on changing our democracy and making it better. And bless the university, maybe lessons to be learned. The School of Government doesn't talk much to the bit of the university that asks people for libraries. So the Vice-Chancellor's office here that's saying, please donate, the School of Government says, look, with respect, you're an idiot. Go read these five books. Come back when you know something. It's a perfect way to work with Luca, because he read the five books and came back and said, it turns out I was completely wrong. Donations is a tiny part of why we don't trust the system. There are fundamentally better changes we can make to how our democracy works. So he said to the university, I've called them back 6 weeks later, I've read your books. This is fantastic. Who's doing it? And the university sort of hemmed and hawed and said, well, we don't do them so much as, but we release fantastic papers. Well, why? There's a gap. Well, it's expensive, it's hard, someone has to pitch up to the MPs and someone's got to deliver it. I said, oh, how expensive is this going to be? I said, well, we'd need $2 million to start. Okay, well, let's start. And that was the origins of New Democracy. We are a bridge between conceptual work in academia that looks at less adversarial and more representative models and the world of mayors, MPs, premiers in this case, of the practical problems and challenges they face in democracy. Now, a lot of people start from the point of view that politicians are bad people, particularly the ones you didn't vote for. And you can mount the argument on either side really easily. It's an easy argument to make. It's also fun occasionally to pick on people. And we take a simpler starting point. This is not about finding better politicians. This is a systemic and structural issue. So can we build a better system? You can pick your favourite people. You could put Mother Teresa and Santa Claus in Prime Minister and Opposition Leader. Pick the people that you trust. They will behave the same way. The system is designed. The system is structured for highly adversarial behaviour. We were told by he's retired, so we'll name him. John Della Bosca stood up and said, the cardinal rule of politics is that if an elected representative, if your opponent comes out and announces free chocolate for everyone, what do? You get the lactose intolerant, the diabetic, the carob production society, and you line them up. That's a very simple oppositional model. There is nothing you can announce that won't be opposed. And it shouldn't be opposed, because that's the nature of the adversarial system. If you're in opposition, you achieve nothing. You can argue that it's futile. Where we approach this from is, what are you going to do about it? Now, our what are you going to do about it starts in a couple of parts. Firstly, you've got to build an organisation that people are willing to trust. Who would you trust to tinker with your democracy? It's a hard question. We're not saying we've got it right. We're saying we've got one approach. And if there's better ideas out there, you know, my email address is very findable. The starting point we took was, firstly, you've got to have people who've been elected somewhere around. Because the first response is, you want to change something, get elected. So we've taken a couple of former premiers, ideally people trust. For those who vote leaning to the left, Jeff Gallop is someone a lot of people look at and say, oh, I trust him. For those who vote leaning to the right, Nick Greiner has been a successful state premier that people say, you know, he represents the values and achievements that I'm happy to take forward. And we've been very careful to assemble that on a very balanced basis between left and right. So that's a political realist tier. And it's those people who have been there and done that and saying things need to change that makes an impact. Second to that is we have an academic base that extends from ANU and the University of Sydney through to the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. We don't just go out with, frankly, things we've thought of ourselves. We take that which is, we try to not have the holy war of academia, of we have the one best idea. We just apply a simple test. If a proposal will be less adversarial and more representative, then we'll try it. That's as simple as it is. It helps us to avoid that point where an academic will say, it's my way and everything else is flawed. We try to be the broad church. Beyond that, we only work for government. We only do practical, real-world trials. We started out working in local government for a mayor who approached us and said, I've got the standard political problem. This is my local government revenues look like this. My costs look like that. So do I want to be the mayor who cuts services, or do I want to be the mayor who raises rates? It's politically impossible. And that's mainly what we take on. So what we do is design democratic processes and operate them. And ideally, we do it in a way that's beyond politics, because people, dare I say it quite rightly, don't always trust that if it was a media organisation, if it was a single political party, would you trust them to be the operator or designer? If a political party stood up and said, we have this great innovation in democracy, I think a large number of you would say, maybe you've just gained that so that it helps your side. Equally, we don't have a position on any issue. As we were approached for the project we did in South Australia, which was broadly briefed in as we have a problem with alcohol-fuelled violence, the starting point we took was, we don't care if you have prohibition or you hand out tinnies in preschools. We simply don't care. What comes back comes back. That's why we never do the same issue twice. So we've done energy inquiries, we've done local government reviews, we're moving into planning laws in a different state. It avoids the perception that, oh, you're secretly trying to get, pick your issue of choice, you're secretly a green group, you're secretly a business group. I've heard them all. What did we do in South Australia? Well, when Premier Wetherill came to office quite some time ago now, a year and a half ago now, maybe longer, our phone rang that day, which was, here's a guy who likes your stuff. It was that direct, that there were people who knew that he had a personal preference for looking, can you innovate in democracy? Can we engage with citizens in a more substantive way? Government doesn't engage with you substantially today. There is a ream of requirements of how they're meant to go out to the community. And the standard approach is to come out with a draft document. Here's our draft. We'd like your comments. And two things happen. I tell you what, the draft never changes. They count up, hey, we got 153 comments back. Did you change anything? Oh, absolutely not. But we got 153 comments, and they love reporting that number back. So our starting point is no drafts. We start with a blank sheet of paper. If you want to hear what the community has to say, don't shop it up front, because you can sell absolutely anything in a draft document. If you're doing an inquiry and you write the solution there, you're actually not really listening to people. That was condition number one. Condition number two. Most of that feedback that you may get, if you are adventurous and have enough free time to respond to a government call for the community, is we'll go into the middle of a department somewhere, and you'll never hear of it again. So the requirement we made of the Premier's office is, you've got to commit a level of authority in advance. If as a citizen, I'm going to jump back to a council example that we had. When we first knocked on the door of a local council in Sydney, and I said, how does community engagement work for you? The mayor concerned put his head in his hands. He said, oh, it's terrible. It's awful. Do you know the same three people come all the time? Seriously, we know them. It's up, Frank, Steve. You know, and they have grievances that go back 10 years. And he gave me a very simple illustrative story about parks and play areas. This particular council had 146 parks and play areas with rocking horses, seesaws, the general small-scale play equipment. Thank you for nodding. I'm terrible with this stuff. And at a certain period of time, you've got to replace them. And the choice, for the same amount of money, the choice, you can have the same little rocking horse and slippery dip in every park, or you can have the giant three-storey plasticated thing you see at McDonald's, rubberized flooring, looks like a space station. I think if you're this tall, they're awesome. But you can only do about, I think they're going to do about 18 super parks through the area. There's your trade-off. It's a trade-off question. So they called for the voice of the community. Those three people turned up. One of them apparently literally getting out of the rain. Just, oh, this is fantastic. You've got tea. Oh, this is wonderful. So they had no voice from the community. What do? You're the elected representative. What do? You do what you think is right. So they took a decision. Anyone want to guess what happened? Community Action Group formed. They went the super parks option. It was suggested that the super parks were put near the mayor's house. His kids are 22. They must be having an awesome time on the slippery dip. It was suggested he knew the supplier. You know, it was suggested that he had connections and kickbacks, all these things that went on. There was a fake mayor's Twitter account created. He took a form email from about 300 people and just turned to me and said, what do you want me to do? We fulfil the law of engagement with the community. There's this thing that just operationally, it's one of 100 things that goes past you where you say, just make a decision. We can't make trusted decisions anymore. That's the problem. It's not about what the decision is. It's that nobody trusts it. I want you to think of the last political decision you saw where you thought, oh, that's fair enough. Even if you perhaps, especially if you didn't vote for the person concerned. So the mayor at that point had said, well, what do you want me to do? And the example I gave, I'm a little Sydney specific, sorry, but there's a road there, Lyons Road. It used to be a state road, used to be a 70 zone, then it became a 60 zone, then it became a 50 zone. I'm working on the assumption there's no police in the room. I hold a personal view that if you couldn't do 80 along there, you should be on the bus. It's a long, flat, straight road. And I said to the mayor, if you called for community engagement about the speed limit on that road, I'm not going. I'm not going because I actually think you've already cooked up the answer with the roads authority anyway. I think you're just going through a show pony exercise of ticking a box and humouring me. You're probably going to put me in a room full of the absolutely insane, the people who have a grievance about their pool fence from a decade ago who are absolutely going to go mental about that. It's going to be a slightly sad experience that has no point. Why would I go? To his credit, he said, yeah, that's what we do. So what would you do? I said, well, in this circumstance, you actually don't care what the speed limit is. As long as the community voice is reflected, then that's a decision you're happy to devolve. I'll tell you a decision I'd trust. If you told me you'd picked a jury of 30 citizens at random, because we trust juries to lock people up for a very long period of time, so I think we can trust them on a speed limit and how often the bins get picked up. And I don't want an opinion poll decision. I don't want public opinion. I want public judgment. Judgment is going to come as a result of time, information, and access to experts of their choosing. Because I know the road expert that comes from the RTA has his view to preach, as I know that road experts, no doubt from the NRMA, road experts from Holden who sell V8s, that should be 100 through there. We're going to let the jury themselves pick the experts. And if they can find common ground, not absolute unanimous room, but if 29 out of 30, 28 out of 30 actually got to a point where they said this is the decision, could you live with it? The answer is yes. Overwhelmingly, this is an attractive offer to our elected representatives. They actually want to find these areas where there is common ground. It's often brought up that we had a Prime Minister who suggested a Citizens' Assembly on climate change. Didn't go that well. I think the idea lasted about 4 hours before there was a good, solid decision that we will never, ever, ever have a Citizens' Assembly on climate change. And a year and a half ago, for the coalition government in New South Wales, we did a jury on renewable energy options for the state, which, if you read between the lines, is very, very close to doing a Citizens' Assembly on climate change. And it actually reached a unanimous view. We ran it in a regional and state area. It was interesting that while MPs will occasionally lean into you and say, sorry, it's a Sydney reference, but they say, will I get a Daily Telegraph view or a Sydney Morning Herald view back, do you think? Just like to know in advance. And the answer is always, it will be nothing like either. If you actually encourage, hopefully any of you, to look at something for 50 or 60 hours and hear from experts of your choosing, you'll end up at a far deeper place than we get in the current level of discourse. Indeed, our elected MPs don't get the chance to spend this much time on issues because they're generally responding to, have you fired a staffer? Have you done your travel expenses correctly? And particularly on the latter question, a lot more time is spent on that. So what was our experience in South Australia? Point was made. We generate, if you can, probably made the leap already. If you take 30 or 40 people and put them in a room, we generate uncontrolled results. Our model of democracy today is built around controlled results. So we are an adventurous high-risk choice for elected MPs. How did we end up on the topic we're in? We were fortunate to get some time with the Premier, and we started the conversation with what's hard. And he brought up this topic related to alcohol-related violence, where he said, you know, we've been sitting on this as a party and a parliament and a government for a couple of years and you get nowhere. Why? If the Premier announces tighter regulations, can you write the headlines? He's the nanny state and he's the fun police. The Premier doesn't announce tighter regulations. Can you write the headlines? You're not protecting our kids. You're letting the mayhem run. You can't win. Now let's go one more level. Mindful this is being recorded. Let's go one more level. Let's say they managed to come up with a technically perfect solution. They have a holy grail policy document that will solve all problems related to this. And they announce, we have this policy that will solve all problems. We've had the greatest minds in the world on it. About 95% of the population will look at that and think, gee, you've got a few big donors and lobby groups out there. I bet they had a hand in writing this. I bet they got a first look at it. Is that unfair? He said, so there is actually no trusted decision. We do not have the structure in place to reach a trusted decision on this issue. What would you do? And there is absolutely interest in the jury model, because while we do other things, it's the one that's most understandable, because we trust lotteries, we trust criminal juries. We don't see someone get convicted and say, oh, he probably got a Labor jury. Oh, he probably got a Greens jury, whatever it may be. It's just people like me. As we went through our conditions, what are our conditions? We control selection, because the most common response is, I bet government stacked this with their mates. Ideally, where it's a Labor government, people look at an organisation that includes Lucy Turnbull and Nick Greiner and says, probably not doing favours for the Labor Party. And the same holds true on the reverse when we look at, I think we're the only organisation with John Della Bosca and Nick Greiner in the same room, not natural allies. Our second requirement is we're going to pre-commit to a level of authority. Whatever comes back, verbatim, you take to Cabinet, you take to Parliament. And also, you've got to give people a personal response. If they're going to invest time, it does not go into the black hole. We want you to come and respond to it personally and directly. Because if I'm a citizen that's not in the turning up to every council meeting I can and everything to protest, you've got to make a reasonable offer. There's a reason people don't come to things. It's because they have no impact. And that's what we change. The Premier agreed to those three conditions. Who did this terrify? I think the look on the face of the advisers as they lean in and say, Premier, this group could ask us to legalise ecstasy. What do we do? That's politically terrifying. Would we get a look at the report maybe before it came out? No. The joy of who we are is we're not a consultancy. We don't need the billings. So it's just a case of these are our conditions. You take them as they are, or there's other people to work on. The Premier was good enough to say, we'll deal with what comes back. We're stuck with where we're at today, so we'll take our chances. People are reasonable. In every single piece of work we do, there's always at least one on a council, there's always at least one in the advisers, who assumes the worst will happen. When we did range of services in a council, someone said, what if people just want to cut all the costs and get rid of Meals on Wheels? And we simply said it won't happen. But you can retain, as long as we can agree a level of authority, just set the parameters of what's in for discussion and what isn't. In practice, it didn't happen. So our South Australian experience was that we were able to actually take a jury of 43 people and show them an open question, but also show them a question that had a pre-agreed level of authority. Why come along? You're coming along because your voice will go directly to Parliament. Come along because we can get you any of the experts that you want. One of the first requests the jury made was we want to hear from the Commissioner of Police. Reasonable, if you actually want to look at the scope of the problem, let's get him along. The Commissioner was happy to appear. They asked us to hear from, I got given the question, because we start from a very simple point. What do you need to know and who would you trust to inform you? Because if you separate those two things out, you can steer things. And one of the early questions came back was, we'd like to know of a culture of excess alcohol consumption can be changed, and we'd like to hear from a nationally recognised academic who's published in this area. And there's essentially two. One was overseas, which made it fairly simple in terms of selection, and Steve Allsop from the National Drug Research Institute came along and gave a lot of that discussion. Think of it as being at a really good dinner party, the kind of thing where you come home and you say, you wouldn't believe who I sat next to. Gee, I really wish we could hear from person X, and because we have 3.5-4 months to run, we can get person X in the room next time. I just want to jump very briefly to the energy inquiry which we ran. A citizen made an insightful comment, and there were five MPs in the back of the room when he said it. They said, look, we actually, on the energy topic, we don't need to hear from a scientist about solar. We get it. What I want to understand is why it's 40 degrees in western New South Wales every other day in summer, and the federal government solar flagship program had just fallen over. Moree Solar Farm was not going to happen. And yet, they've got solar farms outside Berlin, and it's snowing. We simply said, who would you trust to inform you? And it was about half an hour of discussion amongst the room, and they said, we'd like to hear from the lead investor behind the Moree Solar Farm, and we'd like to hear from the most senior person you can get from AGL, who refused to commit to buy 25 years of output from the location. We got the chief executive of Pacific Hydro, who's the investment arm for Australian Super, so $5 billion investor, appeared via video link, and the chief economist for AGL appeared. And it's that kind of access to information. They had 25 minutes just to make their case openly, as hopefully I'm making one today, and then about 40 minutes of Q&A. What was interesting, the recommendations they came back with were not the simple lobbying approach that was taken. Two things came out. They made a recommendation that simply didn't fall on one side or the other. They recognised that there was a balance here about investment security. They recognised that government often tries to pick winners. They came up with a solution that the state government received well, which was instead of picking spot areas for subsidy, the most efficient form of subsidy is the network. We recommend that an amount of funding that currently goes into some fairly dubious levels of government research is repurposed to provide a network subsidy, which will actually provide confidence. If you're building a 30-year plant, the network won't get pulled out by the next government. What happened was that both those people, the AGL economist and the Pacific Hydro CEO, went in the Fin Review the following week and said, we've fronted 15 government inquiries over the last 3 years. We got better questions from 60 random citizens than we did from MPs. Why? Why? Because you get asked the wife beater questions very predictably from each side of politics, which is rational if your main goal is to win and retain office. So, with that diversion in place, in South Australia, we simply said we will recruit at random 43 people. We're going to match it to the census profile. So, technically, it's not a pure random draw, it's a stratified random draw. So, if 8% of your population is 25 to 34, that'll be about the room. That's a simple match. And we ended up with a group of people that roughly looks like who you'll see going down the street. They met five times in person all day. They heard from experts of their own choosing. This is not an effort to make people experts in their own right. This is a synthesis and trade-off task. You can have perfectly safe streets, but I think it's called a curfew. You can have very, very vibrant streets, and we can build Vegas down here if you want, and somewhere in between is the natural element that people find. In every piece of work that we do, something interesting happens, is that people find a hole in what's gone before. It happened this time as well. There's an anomaly in Adelaide's licensing laws. You actually can't play live music in Adelaide before 9 p.m. Now, they heard from academics who said, you know what a vibrant city is? If you have everyone on the street who's 18 to 22 and has had 10 drinks, you get a given level of violence. If, with the same number of outlets, the same number of drinks, and the same number of 18 to 22s, you also have people on the streets who are 25, 35, 45, you get a different reaction. Because think of it this way. If you've had that 10 drinks and you're out with your friends, you'll behave a certain way. If you've had 10 drinks and it's Christmas Day and your grandmother's there, you'll tone it down a little bit. Now, this is not the discussion that normally occurs around this topic. And that's where we saw the jury, while it broke into groups and looked at various ways to address this and how you get a more vibrant nightlife, one group actually stumbled into this area that there are these holes that protect and say, well, we can't play live music before a certain time. Why? Well, it's always been like that. A cynic would suggest that those who operate very large outlets don't want smaller outlets opening. Maybe that's a cynical view. But they were free of the pressures that our elected representatives are on. My jury, not up for re-election, won't be selected again, not in a faction, doesn't care about their press profile. All these pressures on judgment. And even if they're not real pressures, they're perceived pressures. How often when you see an elected representative stand up, do you think, oh, that's just spin because they want to say that in front of the cameras? If there are any yellow vests and a hard hat, you may be right. But overwhelmingly, we start to perceive poor intentions, whether they're there or not. We've now reported back to the Premier's office. The Premier fulfilled his commitment, turned up in person yesterday, spoke with the jury, got some fantastic questions. The final juror's question that we heard was, Mr Premier, we understand you'll probably lose the election, so what's going to happen with our results? Not the question you generally get from a lobbyist who assures people that they're going to win the election. And it showed the stark difference between interest group engagement and citizen engagement. And to his credit, he did say, well, it would be nice if you'd vote for me and stop me losing the election. But also gave the serious answer of what parts they'll commit to try to take to Parliament beforehand. What does the Foundation do? We're trying to show practical live fire trials. These are not conceptual pieces of work. You can see the juries. You can see the legislative impact you want. You can decide if you like it or not. We're not the be-all and end-all of what can change. We are one organisation trying to make a practical impact in terms of what can be run. If it stimulates others to try, that's fantastic. But it was funny when I first spoke to Luca about, well, this job, I said, how did you get involved in this? And he said, well, if you want to change democracy, it's going to be hard. It's going to take a long time and take a lot of money. And if you want to be blunt about it, there's probably 20 people in the country that can afford to do it, and about 18 of them I don't like. So it might as well be us. We're happy for others to try and get involved, and hopefully you take a look and we're transparent enough. You can see where our money comes from. You can see the work we do. You can see who is behind us. It's a big request. It's a big ask to say trust us to redesign elements of how we do democracy. And as I close, I just want to go back to how we started. What is democracy to you? I hope it's more than a vote. We think it's about reaching trusted public decisions that reflect the general will. Whether or not you write a number on a sheet of paper is immaterial. Can we get a representative group of people? You say that's people like me. They're free from the pressures of donors and factions and all the rest and the press. If they can be free of that, will you trust the decision? And is it that the vote is actually a very small part of our democracy? That's what we're about. Happy to take a few or several hundred questions. So thank you for your time.
Well, now we are at the question time. So this will be an opportunity for people to, I think, ask questions, one of the critical things. If we could keep our comments well, let's say none, and just make it questions. There's a microphone just behind, so it's probably easy if people go there because we want to record this, obviously. So if people want to go there, ask their questions, and we'll try and get a bit of a dialogue going. Yes, sir.
I just wonder, there's similar systems, I'm pretty ignorant about this, but there are similar systems in Oregon and in Switzerland, and how do you compare in your results compared with what they do?
Great question. The Oregon example is fantastic. What happened in Oregon? Up and down the west coast of the United States, they have citizens-initiated referenda, and that's the chance to have a ballot initiative and vote directly, direct democracy. We don't do that. And the experience in the US is it's been a disaster because on your ballot, you might get a referenda question that says, would you like 20% of the budget to go on education? Education's fantastic, yes. Would you like 20% of the budget to go on policing and law enforcement? I'll tell you what, policing's in. Yes. You can see where this is going. They ended up with 100% of the budget spent. And then someone had, in the important areas of health and policing and education, should we mandate that the budget never falls? Oh, that looks important. Yes. And then the GFC hit. And tax revenues fell. And they had actually written rules that said, we cannot cut our spending. We cannot increase our taxes, and we must spend at the same level. And that's challenging for anyone. Now, what happened in Oregon is a group very like us. We know them pretty well, and it's actually one of the originators of the jury model in a public policy sense, Ned Crosby. And Ned approached the legislature, as he's approached many around the US. It's been a 15, 20-year mission. And said to them, I want to try something. The next time you get a ballot initiative, which always goes the way of who advertises the most. The next time we do that, we're going to get a jury of 24 citizens, go through the process I've described, and you're going to staple their recommendation to the front of the ballot paper. It's not going to be an ad or an informational. Every time you hand out a ballot paper, you're going to have the citizens initiated review attached to it. And the legislature said, crazy idea, but we're stuck, so we'll try anything. So they committed to a 2-year trial. In that 2-year trial, the research showed one thing. Citizens don't vote blindly with the recommendation, but they broke the nexus between who advertises the most and the results that got through. The most common response, and as they exit polled people and said, why did you vote the way you do, was the issue is complicated, but I trust people who look like people like me. It's a very simple response. We don't trust interest groups and expert groups as much as we trust people we've picked blindly. In 2011, the legislature voted on a bipartisan basis, doesn't happen that much, to make it permanent. So the Oregon model shows one very practical proof of concept, which is be useful, work within the system. A lot of people look howl at the moon and say we must break everything and build a new model. It's not going to happen. This was practically useful and effective and built a better democratic model. What's happened in practice is the actual number of citizens-initiated referenda coming up has declined, mainly because people have realised, well, I could sell this in a 30-second ad, but I couldn't get it past people who looked at it for a prolonged period of time, so I won't even attempt it. It's been useful to legislators and it's delivered better outcomes. They're the high watermark around the world of what's been achieved in changing the system. So, Switzerland is a less good example, and I say that because people look and say, oh, we are stuck with two parties. Switzerland, in their majoritarian system, has five, and they also don't work on a simple majority for decisions. What this means in practice is that out of five parties, there is one far-right party who's anti many things related to immigration and et cetera. And the other four parties are always in coalition. Voters have responded very logically, which is, well, if we can't kick this consistent coalition out, we will vote for people who we simply are not the other four. So the far right vote has now surged to 28 or 30% of the last vote. They started at 6 or 7, and no one will form an alliance with them, but increasingly the electorate is saying, well, we don't like this four over here. They have many clever things at a local level that reflect what we do in terms of consensus decision-making in community, but at a federal level, they're tied in worse knots than many countries around the world. So it's potentially not a great example.
Thank you, sir.
With your Australian clients, can you run through again, if you've already done it, the process by which you select the citizens in the group and how many numbers for particular issues that you're dealing with?
Okay. Without having a Sunday morning statistical discussion, which will just... people will be stabbing themselves. Very simply, we work on two key statistical drivers, 95% confidence level match to the community. And where we differentiate from an opinion poll, most opinion polls work on either plus or minus 0.1% or plus or minus 1%. Now, we're seeking consensus in a room. In an opinion poll, it matters a great deal whether it's going to be 51% 49 or 52 48. We have a minimum threshold at 80%, and in practical terms, 95% of the room wanting to make a decision. In real, hard practical terms, out of 43, we had one dissenting voice on one recommendation. And what that means is plus or minus 1% is meaningless to us. We stretch that to plus or minus 10%, because whether 90% or more than 100% of people would go along with this if repeated is a fair statistical measure. That's how we end up with the numbers of 43. How we select them, it varies by what is the community in terms of local area. We don't use the electoral rolls. In New South Wales, we were viewed as being not in the public interest, which was a fantastic definition from the electoral commissioner. The best database that we use here in South Australia, Australia Post have a database of every address they've successfully delivered mail to. It's more complete than the electoral rolls, which are missing at least 2 million people, and we see this as a very fair capture. On any database, you simply can pull a random extract. If you work back from our 43, we want to be drawing that from a pool of at least 500. We know our response rates vary between 5% as a minimum. Our peak response rate to a direct mail piece is 38%. In South Australia, you always want to make sure your pool is big enough. So a first-round invitation went out to 22,000 people by post. We try and make it look like a royal wedding invitation so people actually open the envelope. And it says, the Premier invites you to be part of this process. Here are the dates. And we put the authority on it. Your recommendation will go to Parliament. Your recommendation will be responded to in person by the Premier. In South Australia, about 7% of people responded and said, yeah, I'll do that. Tick. And they register electronically with us, which gives us the large sample. And it also gives us a basic demographic collection because we ask people to declare their age bracket because I want to match the census profile. I need to know if you're 18 to 24 or so on and so forth. We then use Excel to do a simple random stratified extract. You simply say 10% of the population is this age. Do me a random draw where 10% of it is in that category. So this is hopefully a shortish answer to your question. We use in South Australia, we use the Australia Post addressable database. We sometimes use land titles databases because, again, they're extremely complete. They know every address that's there to get the biggest possible sample. And from that, we do an initial opt-in for time. So it's not perfectly random. There's absolutely a measure of self-selectivity, but it's far less than in most other models. And then it's simply an Excel draw. Now, for those of you who pick up the occasional papers, yes, in the jury that we just ran, our random draw managed to pick up the opposition leader's head of communications, which some in the media found excessively amusing. And all we did and pointed to was most people think that government processes are filled with people who like, or you know, the government or the proposal. You ever wanted proof that these things aren't staged? No one would pick that person deliberately. And he was great. He came to every meeting. He participated. And I think it was a great exposure for him to say, I understand why this is useful, not to put words in his mouth. So that's the basic statistical selection model that we do. I call all the participants twice because we're heavily dependent. Our single point of failure is the 43 we pick need to show up on the first day. You know, my natural enemy in this process is rain. I've got one. I can see one juror in the room today. That first day, there was a monsoon. It was absolutely cyclonic. Everyone showed up. What was noticeable for us is we don't lose people. If we can get them there on the first day, they stick. But that first day is terrifying. And that's our basic statistical model.
Thanks. The examples that you gave there were things like solar power and the like, which already have a bit of a public notice, a bit of public traction. I'm wondering, with an issue like, say, changing regulations about the fact that in Australia all cyclists are required to wear helmets, which is out of line with pretty much every other country in the world, it's an issue that some people have an interest in, but it's not necessarily a big, sort of big-ticket public thing. How do you make traction on something like that and convince lawmakers that they should actually pay attention to a citizen jury for an issue that hasn't necessarily, you know, hit the radar?
Okay, three-part answer to this question. Firstly, there is a best fit for what we do. It's not for everything. And in my first week in this job, look, some of the great and good former elected officials said to me, you know where to focus? Crime, tax, planning. You want things that people don't trust and are politically poisonous? That's your shortlist, and I take your point. That's not in there. The next step is when we meet with elected representatives, our opening question is, what's hard? See if it comes up on that list. If there's a decision where they're getting lobbied from two sides and there is no middle ground, we like to describe most of our democratic model looks like a bell curve. So on any given issue, there's a bike helmet, there'll be potentially a helmet manufacturer's lobby saying, really important everyone wears a helmet, perhaps two. And there'll be a group of people saying, you know what, helmets, this is the worst thing, I can't believe it, you're stopping people picking up bikes, it's the end of the world. And that's the only two voices our democracy is geared to hear from, those who are passionate about the topic. And then we hand to elected representatives and say, find a middle ground. Well, the voices you've heard from have no middle ground. It's quite binary. So where we'd need to find where that becomes attractive is where the elected official wants to make a decision. Why the process works is that invariably everyone thinks they have God on their side. That's why this works. That's why this gets taken on, is you can say to both lobbies, if 40 people just like you looked at all the information, would they agree with you? Oh, absolutely. That's the most common response. Whether you're the alcohol lobby or the quieter neighbourhoods group, everyone thinks they're right. And they look at us and trust us enough to say, well, it doesn't seem that you deeply can care as an organisation. Do we care if you wear a helmet? Please, I hope you can see that we don't have that topical issue. You need an elected representative to want to do it. The number one thing I've learned is trying to get the bureaucratic tier to recommend up, it's a little bit courageous. It doesn't happen. We talk with the elected tier, and if they find it hard, if they want to take a decision, then it'll happen. Where it's a good fit is deep down, they're not going to live or die on it, so they probably would be happy to devolve the decision. What it gives you the chance to do, and the big positive is, generally most lobbyists, if you want to not have bike helmets, I got the feel of it, most lobbyists will knock on the door and say, you have to make this decision. Oh, yeah, that's hard. If you knock on the door and say, I want you to do a jury process and I can live with the result, you've given them something that's easy to say yes to. So it is viable.
You mentioned very early on that if there's an issue where the political divide is unattractive either way, or that any result was going to be politically untenable,
yep,
that the Citizens' Assembly becomes a very attractive political option. Now, is that just a result of a political mind sitting there just going, okay, no matter what happens, I can defer the blame to this citizens' jury? Or is that a political mind saying something needs to be done, I just don't want to be responsible for it? Or are they the same thing?
They're sort of the same thing. So my answer to you is both. I want to give you an example of a project that didn't happen, but it's in the last federal government now, so it doesn't matter. I want you to think of the Henry Tax Review. A lot of nods. I'm going to put myself in the barrel. I'm hoping no one's actually read it. You know, it's irrational way to spend your time. I've got one. Thank you for wrecking my example. There's a phrase called rational ignorance, which you're not going to like. Rational ignorance is built around the fact that when you say people aren't informed on this, well, why would you be? You can't change the decision. Take your wife out to dinner, play with your kids, get a hobby. There's no reason you should be reading it. I don't know what you're doing. Okay, rational knowledge. So within that, this goes to your point. The discussions we had, and they were on both sides of politics, and frankly the two independents as well, and it was Rob Oakeshott that made the comment, you know, if you took the Henry Tax Review and you show the next 100 people in the street, don't just show it to them, say, I want you to read this, come back to me in 3 months, and I will pay. If they want to go and talk to their accountant or someone they trust or a tax, anyone they want, you know what would happen? In 3 months, those people would come back to me. 95% of them would say, do it all. And 5% would say, you can do a little more. But as a parliament, it's poison. The first person to say tax loses. It is a vote loser, as is, frankly, alcohol regulation. We know the polling firms on both sides of politics, and changing regulations to alcohol is basically 4 points off your primary vote. It's that linear. It's not rational to expect people to take a decision when that measure of penalty sits over their head. Is it politically cynical to defer it to a jury? Look, I would use the word pragmatic. I don't mean to be a weasel word, but why would you get yourself voted out of office on a principle when, you know, it's much nicer being in government? So it's we've heard the phrase, we are the intersection of good politics and good policy. And hopefully it's by maintaining both streams that this is practical. And tax is the good example. Regardless of what you think of the left or the Liberals or the Labor Party, whoever brings up tax first, the other side will just bang the drum and beat them. It was Rob Oakeshott who made the point. We have taxes that cost 9 cents in the dollar to collect. We have taxes that cost 66 cents in the dollar to collect. Do you realise what that makes possible? We could actually collect the same amount of tax and give everyone a tax cut at the same time. It's actually possible, and yet because there'd be certain winners and certain losers, it's only the losers that you ever hear from. People don't march in the streets to say things are fine. That's really the problem we try to address.
Climate change is quintessentially a problem about which we need community consensus. So I've got two questions, given that the issue is so polarised. One is, do you think that it would be possible to apply your model to the resolution of the climate change issue? And secondly, do you have a look at the political profile of the people who actually take part in your processes, that those who actually are engaged?
So I'll do your second question first. No. While we get very used to saying that the community is 50% or 50.1% one way and 49% the other, in practice, party membership is so low that it's well under 1% of the population is a member of a political party. So in really basic statistics of sampling, you're unlikely to hit two people who are partisans. Now, if you take a room and ask to seek consensus, we had someone who was clearly a party member in this local process. Firstly, people don't want to be the very loud voice in the room because there's moderation of 40 other people saying, oh, sit down, that's a bit much. So where you get a room full of 40 very partisan people, which you do if it's self-selected, the enraged and the articulate show up, you get one dynamic. Sampling actually gives us the natural diversity. We're often asked, do we do a stratification by self-identified ethnic background? The answer is you don't need to. People are equivalently interested across cultures. There are some moderate exceptions where it's not historically acceptable to challenge authority. But we found in Sydney that we've been able to overcome that, that we end up with a group that looks very much like the community. To go back to your first question, is it an appropriate fit? We are not a crisis management tool. So at the point an issue is very hot is not the time to say, handball, here's a citizen's jury, because the public will go, it looks like you're just trying to avoid a decision you should be making. If an issue is not currently red hot, it's a good time. The New South Wales Parliament example that we run, we were approached by an MP who said, I've been commissioned to run an energy inquiry. He's a coalition MP. So when you think about this, we can look at all the facts in good faith. There's a given set of recommendations we can reach that would look very much like coalition policy, and a lot of the public would view that cynically. There's another set of recommendations we could reach that would look, like I was sucking up to my wealthy North Shore electorate that doesn't care what power prices are and that the Liberal government isn't going to do anyway, and people will view them cynically. That's actually the set of all possible outcomes. All possible outcomes of my next six-monthly inquiry will be viewed cynically. Why am I doing this? And that's why he commissioned us. Now, it was a special moment going back to our research committee, who we're obviously trying to do proofs of concept to show that innovation is possible. There were a couple of great comments about you're taking on an energy inquiry. If you ever want something that'll blow up, this is it. We set a tier of 80% in the room is where a decision is made. We don't discard the 20%. We simply record a minority view. And in the New South Wales example, I'll give you an outcome example of where there was a split view. We actually found unanimous results. We ran this simultaneously in Sydney CBD and in Tamworth to get a regional view, and it returned a unanimous view. And what was interesting is for MPs on both sides of the divide, they've got very used to a binary argument and a talking point argument. I can do still the five recommendations pretty much off the top of my head. And why they're interesting is they didn't reflect anything that was in the press at the time. And 3 weeks later, the Productivity Commission completed their 14-month report and mirrored the same five recommendations. And it showed the ability of people to get to an issue in detail. Let me give you one example. I mentioned earlier they were hearing from an AGL speaker. And people asked, we keep hearing a lot about the gold plating of the network. What's happening? They said, well, we have a requirement from the government that the power basically doesn't go out. And on a 40-degree day, everyone's switching on their air conditioners and we have to be able to handle it. Someone simply asked, is there any other way you could handle it? I said, well, yeah, on that same 40-degree day in New South Wales, we'll be keeping 4 million water heaters at 45 degrees. We can switch them off. There's a technology out there that would simply allow us to turn that off for an hour. So we sell your electricity at 25 cents. If you let us do that, we'll give you $10. It's actually worth our while to pay you $10 an hour to turn things off just occasionally. And people looked at this and went, well, that seems like a much better option. Why aren't you doing it? It's illegal in New South Wales. We're prohibited from offering that. There's a great moment in a room when 40 jurors all turn around at the same time to the five MPs who just what? How? Why do we expect our MPs to be across everything? Government is impossibly big. It's impossibly complicated. It's important to set the expectation. A jury can't solve an issue. Okay? This is about a synthesis and a trade-off. There was an MP, Michael Daly, who's the Shadow Treasurer. He sat back and laughed and he said, that's fantastic. I can write the headlines. Lights go off in New South Wales. And I mean this in a positive way because he was just laughing to a couple of the libs of how impossible it is to suggest that in a political environment. The jury came back with a very simple, clear recommendation. Permit demand management technology in New South Wales. Didn't try to technically describe all the regulations. They just said, our view is this is okay. And what it meant is that either side of politics wasn't game to attack it. You know what a jury looks a lot like? Voters. That's why you can actually put more on the agenda for discussion. Governments are not expected to accept everything. There was an interesting part of where the nuclear energy debate is at. Again, just to save the rocks getting thrown, we don't have a view. We're just reflecting what the jury's view here is. Now, the nuclear debate is almost politically even more poisonous. The jury came up with a recommendation that said, we don't like nuclear energy today. We understand that Generation 4 thorium reactors will consume their own waste. These are likely to emerge in around 2035. It'll probably take us around 20 years to agree where to site them. So the siting discussion for Generation 4 reactors should start today. And that's one where MPs say, but we don't get that back out of market research. That's far more detail than you can otherwise get to. Why? Because we're getting people for 50 hours. Across 3 months, we have time to read. They asked for nuclear experts of their choosing. We don't want to hear from a lobby group. We don't want to hear from a reactor maker. We'd like to hear from a mining company that extracts multiple materials, including uranium, because they win all ways. So we'd like to hear their view. And it should be someone with a commercial background and a scientific background. The chairman of Link Energy used to also be on the CSIRO board. That was identified as the expert. She connected in. And it was a good example of where people could get a technical view and make a trade-off decision that has expanded what the MPs are able to discuss and consider. Because as it is, the first person to bring up nuclear in any generation, in any form, regardless of what you think of it, it's politically impossible up until that point. So it can work, but it can't work at the point that it's at fever pitch. I really need to give shorter answers.
We have time for one last question, and possibly one answer.
Yes, I would just like to ask you a question. When I was at high school, I decided two things. I was going to become more interested in local planning and development, happened at high school, and also I started a project in year 12 where I decided to become vegetarian, and I've stayed vegetarian ever since. At this Festival of Ideas, they set up a fruit and vegetable shop in Hindmarsh Square, and I put up a notice on that fruit and vegetable shop. I said, why don't you put a butcher's shop next door and highlight that? Because the fruit and vegetables in that shop are rotting, and I felt it was a waste of food and absolutely disgusting. And it was going to be discussed yesterday, but I had to work, and the sign was ripped off. So don't you think governments have a role, an important role, to take a leadership role in these types of activities rather than simply to handball them over to what are called, whatever you've called them today, because vegetarians are only around 6,000 in South Australia, and yet there are horrible things happening to animals right across worldwide.
The unfortunate part of my role is I'm not allowed to express a view on any issue. We are, no matter how seemingly obvious things may be, we're not an issue-based group. So the minute I offer one answer in support or opposing something, we become aligned with a given issue. So I'm sorry, it's actually a question I can't answer.
But isn't that financially driven? And doesn't that affect how we operate as a whole community when we just become so dollars-driven and that's it?
I'm not close enough to the festival,
you've made a good point, and I think the people here have heard it. Ladies and gentlemen, it would have to be extremely fast. And I'm...
Thanks for letting me squeeze this last question in. The citizen jury is really exciting. The point you made about the jury held in South Australia was that the recommendation will be given to the parliament, and they said, well, you'll be elected out and won't come in. So that could be really damaging to our confidence in the process if you don't have bipartisan support from opposition and government. So what are you doing in that area to get that support?
Okay, short two-part answer. Firstly, the Premier's committed that some elements of it they will move on in the current term. So action very quickly is part A, has been discussed with Department of Premier. Secondly, I think you will have seen a change in style of response from the opposition leader. There was absolutely press on the morning, the heart attack first morning, where the opposition leader called a doorstop outside our first meeting, so the heart rate was a little high. And his initial response was, this is a waste of time, government has the answers, we should do it. It was interesting that his second press conference, and we're new, so this is absolutely fair enough for people to look at it, see it, and change their position, was too much community engagement is window dressing and nothing happens, so we will expect the government to take this seriously. So it's a very positive commitment from opposition leader. The point of us getting the commitment to table it in Parliament, and a point made by the Premier, is by tabling it in Parliament, well, each side of politics gets their chance to show what they're taking seriously, what they choose to move on. Things that go to departments are easy to bury. Things that go into parliaments get responded to, and it's on the record. So I think that in those two parts, we will see some form of result. And yeah, authority matters to us immensely. It's only if these things are practical and they work that they're worth doing. We can't keep doing them just for a hobby.
Okay, thank you very much for this, I think, a great insight to this process, how it's going. And thank you all, the hardcore democracy, for being here at 10 o'clock in the morning. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.